BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the programme and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words. And those taking part in this Christmas edition are Dillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton. Here's round one. Try and test their vocabulary. 2 marks if they get the meanings of these words right. Beginning with Dillis Powell. Dillis, we all know what Christmas is, but what exactly is Christmastide?
Christmastide?
Hmm.
Well, it's the tide round Christmas.
Yes, but how much round?
Beginning on Christmas Eve.
Yes, that's a good start.
Well, it could go on till the time we take the decorations down on Twelfth Night.
Yes, it could do that.
Could it?
Yes. I think it'll do. Week or more, and it could go on to Twelfth Night, which begins on Christmas Eve on December 24th. 2 marks. Dennis Norton. Rather different one, this. I'd like to know, what is a symposiarch? S-Y-M-P-O-S-I-A-R-C-H. Symposiarch.
Well, it's a Greek word from the look of it.
Yep.
If I can break it down, I will demolish it into syllables, yeah? Arc at the end.
Yes.
Is like arch, is like chief.
Yes.
Chief of. Sim at the beginning means with.
Yes.
So we've got with at the beginning and chief at the end. Yes. Which leaves us with po c. Now, Po is a river in Italy. And C is Italian for yes. So we have with a river in Italy, yes, chief. I honestly can't envisage a situation in which I would be obliged to say that. Or anybody would. So I resign, Jack. I've broken this word up and I think I've destroyed it.
Half a mark.
I think it's somebody who runs a drinking bout.
Who runs a drinking bout?
Yes.
Oh, somebody runs...
Oh, your partner is helping you a lot.
Yes? Oh, it's somebody who runs a drinking... Oh, wait a minute. It's somebody who runs the symposium.
That's it.
With the accent on drink.
With the accent on drink.
Yes, I think you creep home. I think that's 2 marks. It's the president or toastmaster or feastmaster of a symposium, which is a drinking feast with music and dancing and song and dance, all the rest of it. 2 marks it is. Anne Scott James, what is a Christmas rose?
It's a hellebore.
Yes.
It's rather short, grows near the ground, comes
yes, that's
out
right.
Very soon after Christmas.
And what colour?
Well, it can be, the one grows near us is green, but usually it's a slightly purplish colour.
Mm-hmm.
Or white, nearly off-white, but it isn't pure white, if I might
all
say
right,
so.
That'll do. It's normally regarded as white because there's not very much white about then, except possibly snow.
Looks very doesn't look white against the snow.
It doesn't look white against the snow at all, but very few things do, including our dog. 2 marks. Frank Muir, what is a hogshead?
A hogshead?
Hmm.
It's the opposite to a pig's trotter.
Well, it's far, long way away from it, certainly.
It's also a measure of wine. It's a large barrel.
Yeah. It is a large cask, as Frank Muir says. At one time, it was a liquid measure holding 52.5 imperial gallons, which was 63 old wine gallons. But one has to say that the hogshead has been different sizes at different times and for different liquids. And there was a time when it held something like 140 gallons. So I'm covering myself rather carefully on this point. Well, before we begin round two, I give each team a quotation for them to write down. And I want the two women members of the team to study their quotations, and then at the end of the programme, I shall ask them where those quotations come from. And Dillis Powell and Frank Muir, your quotation is, life is one long process of getting tired. And Anne Scott James and Dennis Norton, here's yours. There is no jollity, but hath a smack of folly. And then at the end of the programme, I shall ask Frank and Dennis to give me their ideas of how these words came to be said or written. Well, the next round is about Dickens, because he's inevitably associated with Christmas, and it's only right we should have a round of quickies about his books. 2 marks, if we get it right. To this part, in A Christmas Carol, Bob Cratchit had 2 children. What were their names?
Had more than 2.
Well, two
the
Indian.
One called Tiny Tim.
Yes.
One called Peter.
Yeah.
And there were lots more.
Girl.
There was a girl called Belinda.
That's right. Tiny Tim and Belinda will do. Two marks it is. Dennis Norden, in what book did Joe Gargery appear, and what was his trade?
That's in Great Expectations.
Yes. Yes.
He was a simple, honest fellow, wasn't he? I can't remember what his trade was.
Unemployed.
He was a layabout.
One out of two. He was a blacksmith. Joe Gargery came in Great Expectations. Oh, yeah. And Scott James. Sam Weller became Mr. Pickwick's servant and friend. What did he do before taking on this job? What was his father's name? And what did the father do for a living?
His father was Tony Weller.
Yes.
Oh, yes, he was a coachman.
And Sam himself?
I should think he blew the horn on the coach. Or was he assistant coachman?
No, he worked at the pub.
Yes, he was...
Shoeshine.
He was Boots.
Boots.
Yes, here we are then. It's Sam Weller was Boots at an inn. His father was called Tony Weller, and his father was a coachman. Thank you. What was Scrooge's Christian name?
Johann Sebastian. But he was called Ebenezer Scrooge.
He was called Ebenezer Scrooge.
Jacob Marley.
Well, we'll try the next round, which is origins and derivations of words or phrases, up to a possible maximum of 3 marks. What I want is to know, first of all, the present meaning, and then how it was derived or how it originated. Beginning, Gillis Powell, very simply with carol.
Carol?
Hmm.
It's now a song sung at Christmas.
Yes. And originally?
A hymn.
It could be that.
This kind of hymn.
It needn't be.
Needn't be.
No. A song with a purpose behind it. But yet not a sea shanty.
Song in Latin.
It could be in Latin too.
Well, that's two could be's, Jack. I mean,
one mark out of three. It is now exclusively, or almost exclusively, used for the songs, hymns sung at Christmas time. It originally meant a dance. It comes from French and Latin words meaning to dance, and the earliest meaning in England was a round dance. And from that came the song that went on with the dance, and hence this kind of cheerful hymn, which is used to be sung by wandering bands of minstrels and was sung most particularly of all at Christmas. Dennis Norden, why was it an old English custom to bring in the boar's head as a Christmas dish? In fact, it's sometimes done today in some circles.
Well, I'll tell you why, Jack, because if they didn't bring it in, you'd have to go and eat it out in the kitchen. That's why they brought in the boar's head. I think I've answered that question.
Yes, well done, well done.
In a court of law, I've
definitely
answered that.
Definitely, yes.
It's a very good short answer. And we'll give you half a mark for inventiveness. In fact, it comes from the northern countries, Scandinavia. The god of peace and plenty was called Freya, and he used to ride on a boar. And the boar had a most wonderful name. He was called Gullinbursti. And he always had, the festival of this particular god was always held at Yuletide, which had nothing to do with Christmas originally, but which, as often happened, the Christian church turned over to Christian uses, just like they turned over the Roman Saturnalia. And so, as the time became recognized as Christmas, the boar's head was brought in and as a Christmas dish and a Christian dish rather than in honor of this pagan god. Long story, I'm sorry. Now, back to Anne Scott James. The phrase, pomp and circumstance.
What does it mean now?
Yes, and originally.
It just means a terrific carry-on, like the Lord Mayor's show or something of the sort.
Yes, yes. And origin?
Something to do with the Roman emperors.
In a sense, it could.
It's a march by another quarter mark extra for that.
Yes, you get two, I think, out of that, because I think it does go right back originally to the triumphs with all sorts of shows.
And oh, had, yes.
And when you brought your prisoners.
Scythe chariots and slaves clanking along in chains.
Jewelry
behind.
And all the rest of it. But I think the actual phrase is Shakespeare. It comes in Othello. Farewell the neighing steed and the shrill trump, the spirit's perturbing drum, the ear-piercing fife, the royal banner and all quality, pride, pomp and circumstance of glorious war. 2 out of 3, I think. Hank Muir. Holiday.
Holiday is when you are not working. It's a day which you relax. What else do I do for my mark?
Well, derivation. What was it originally?
It's a holy day.
Yes.
It's a red letter day. It's a and feast what? Day.
But the
it was named after a saint, usually, or, yes. or a religious occasion.
That'll do. Yes, that's the bit
which
I wanted.
Anniversary.
Holiday now being just a break from work or a vacation, but this is a curious corruption of a word which was once completely religious in its meaning, and was holy day, as Frank says, and reserved for saints' days and similar occasions of religious festival, so that you stopped work not in order to go off in your car to the sea, but in order to devote the day to prayer and fasting, or in some cases feasting, but definitely with a religious background. 3 marks. And then the next round. Christmas is a great time for toasts and epigrams and limericks and things like that. Can you, for 2 marks, give me the endings of these lines I'm going to quote? Starting with Dilys Powell, this is a rather servile quotation. I'm sorry, Dilys, about this. Oh, let us love our occupations, bless the squire and his relations, live upon our daily rations.
And remember all our stations.
Near enough. I'll give you 2 marks. In fact, it goes, bless the squire and his relations, live upon our daily rations, and always know our proper stations. Quoted in The Chimes by Dickens, but almost certainly very much older. Dennis Norden, it's good to be merry and wise. It is good to be honest and true.
Oh, Lord, I never heard it. Are we supposed to make it up?
No, not particularly.
Well, we'll have to. it's good to be merry and wise. It's good to be honest and true. But it isn't so good to be misunderstood when you go around to sweep someone's flue.
Definitely 1 out of 2, again, for inventiveness. In fact, goes like this. It's good to be merry and wise. It's good to be honest and true. It is best to be off with the old love before you are on with the new.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Anne Scott James. This is an epigram on Queen Caroline, who died in 1821 and didn't behave terribly well. Most gracious queen, we thee implore to go away and sin no more.
How many more lines?
Oh, I know
two
this.
More. Two more.
Most gracious queen.
Queen, we thee implore to go away and sin no more.
It goes on something about, but even if you do sin, all that matters is go away.
Yes, that's right. That's the sentiment.
Give us one more line. We'll finish it for you.
Next 2 lines rhyme with mate. Not that that word isn't used.
But go away at any rate.
That's it.
Yeah.
1.5 out of 2, I think. Most gracious queen, we thee implore to go away and sin no more. But if that effort be too great, to go away at any rate. Now, Frank, now, there was a young lady of Lynn who was so... Better start again, eh? There was a young lady of Lynn who was so uncommonly thin that when she essayed to drink lemonade...
The rest of the poem's obscene.
All right, half a mark again for invention. There was a young lady of Lynn who was so uncommonly thin that when she essayed to drink lemonade, she slipped through the straw and fell in. And now we come to the last round and go back to those quotations I gave the two teams earlier on the programme. And now for 2 marks, Dilys Powell, can you give me the origin of your quotation, which was, life is one long process of getting tired.
Ah,
life's one process.
Oscar Wilde.
Same... Time, but not that one.
Aubrey Beardsley.
No.
Ernest Dowson.
No, you're bound to get him in the end.
Swinburne.
No, I'm not going to mark you. It's Samuel Butler in his notebooks, chapter 7, Life. Life is one long process of getting tired. And now, Anne Scott James, the origin of your quotation, please. There is no jollity, but hath a smack of folly.
Well, there's been a very nasty spirit of self-righteousness about them. All the questions this evening.
Well, that's Christmas time.
I think this is simply a maxim or proverb. I don't think anybody ever actually said this. I think it's been trad. It's trad, passed on.
I think it'll
from
do.
Smug generation to smug generation.
I think it'll do. I think it's an old proverb. It's quoted by Herbert, George Herbert, in Outlandish Proverbs in 1640, but obviously it was a proverb by the time he quoted it.
So imagine if it was outlandish in 1640.
Yes, just think when it started.
Gone quite a long way since then. I think you'll get your 2 marks. And I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanations of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation receives the longer amount of applause from the audience here in the theatre. So back to Frank Muir with his quotation, life is one long process of getting tired.
A couple of days ago, I was going through the loft looking for some coal, and I found a box with some old Christmas cards in it. This is very unusual, because normally we don't keep Christmas cards, we use them. It's a kind of small saving of money, which is quite helpful over the Christmas period, when we get a card in saying something like Christmas greetings from George Trowbridge. I just write "and Frank Muir" and send it on to somebody else. So it was rather surprising to see this card, which is rather old and mildewed, and suddenly I looked at it and realized it was from an old flame when I was a boy. It said there, Christmas greetings from Mary Glod. I remember her. She was a sweet girl, couldn't spell very well, I remember. And I knew Mary Gold when I was 12 or 13, I suppose, at Broadstairs. She's a very difficult girl to describe. Most of the time I looked at her from the back, because I was very shy. And then I went to the pictures and I saw a Mickey Rooney film. Mickey Rooney played a very young boy. This is going back a bit, isn't it? The Andy Hardy series. And he got on terribly well with his girl. He had a black racing bike. I remember him speeding along and throwing the bike over the fence and leaping over the fence. And he kissed her and caressed her. I was so impressed with this. I spent the whole of the following afternoon painting my bike black. And then I got on it, being very careful that the paint didn't mark my trouser legs, and I didn't touch it with my hands, and I cycled round to this girl's house, to Mary Glod's, and lifted the bike up and tried to... I found actually that Mickey Rooney's quite a strong lad. It took me about 10 minutes to get the bike over the fence. And then I found Mary Glod, and I led her into the potting shed, and I embraced her, and I kissed her. It was my first kiss. It was a marvellous feeling, all sort of exciting, like sort of walking barefoot through jelly. And I did everything. I did everything that Mickey Rooney did to his girl. And I ran my hands through her hair. Then I remembered that to lift a bike, which you've just painted, over a fence, you have to hold it by the frame, which was wet paint. Well, her father, I learned afterwards, spent about a fortnight getting the paint off her. They had to cut all her hair off. For 6 months afterwards, she stank of turps. They had to move to Billericay. It was a year or two after that before I plucked up courage to find another girlfriend. And she was the opposite. Maud, I called her. She was rather barge-shaped, a very big, ample girl. And I suppose I felt that here would be security, you know, with a woman like that behind me. I'd always have somebody to fall back on. And one night, I was then 18, and I borrowed a dinner jacket from my uncle. And I took Maud to a dance, and afterwards I took her on the beach, and there was moonlight, and there was the boat, and I had a little dinghy. I went out fishing, and I just caulked all the seams of the boat that afternoon. It was lying upside down, and I got Maud to sit down on the boat, and I was going to propose to her. And I sat down with her. And you never get a large woman to sit on a boat you've just caulked with pitch, you know, and cotton. It was like, if you can imagine, having a high pile of sandwiches full of chocolate spread and pressing very hard. This pitch came out all over my uncle's 32-pound suit and all over her dress. It took me 5 years to pay them back, her father and my uncle. Then I found a third girl, and Rita, I married her. She was neither too fat nor too thin, and I married her, and I was in trepidation. I was waiting for something awful I knew would happen all through the ceremony, but I didn't trip on anything, I didn't fall over anything. The ceremony went through beautifully. And afterwards we got into my car, and she was in blue, and I had a new tweed jacket on. And we both looked radiant. And as we were driving down to the coast, just on the country road, they were towering half of this country road with one of those little machines which chugs along. And a motorbike suddenly overtook us. There was an oath, a shout, a beep, and the tar spraying machine had tilted. And I was driving my wife through a warm, black stickiness. I wouldn't have minded, you know, the scraping it off the hood of the car, but the hood wasn't up. So looking back over my days of courting, over my love life, when I think of how exhausting it was, I absolutely agree with Samuel Butler when he said, what did he say?
Life is one long process of getting tired.
Well, that's what I mean. Love is one long process of getting tired.
You know, I feel for those girls. Let's go on to Dennis Norden. And his quotation was, "There is no jollity, but hath a smack of folly."
I would like to tell you a story called Dickens Revisited, or Son of Christmas Carol. Because it concerns Ebenezer Scrooge, Jr. And now, very few people know that at the end of A Christmas Carol, Ebenezer Scrooge, now a completely changed man, got married and spent his life raising turkeys, composing mottos for crackers, and revising his Christmas card list completely, so that his son, young Ebenezer Scrooge, grew up in an atmosphere that was very, very pro-Christmas, as he was. He was, in fact, the kindest, most generous, open-hearted, crashing bore that you've ever known, until this one Christmas Eve, when he'd gone to sleep, and he suddenly woke up, and there was a ghostly figure at the foot of his bed, rattling chains, like the three old ladies in the other legend. And he said, "Who are you?" And the figure said, "I have come to show you Christmas past." And by some strange supernatural technical trick, suddenly young Ebenezer saw Christmas past, last Christmas, Christmas last year, the bus strike, the fog, gangs of organized thieves hijacking all the turkeys. That poor bloke in Regent Street who fell down a manhole while looking up at the lovely lights. And Ebenezer Scrooge shrank back. He said, I didn't know. The figure said, "Wait, there is more to come. I will now show you Christmas present." And with switching the supernatural device, he showed him this Christmas. Young Ebenezer saw this Christmas, terrified typists whimpering behind the miscellaneous file at office parties. Plastic Christmas trees, those firms' Christmas luncheons where sales directors come over bad on the pavement outside after. Dustmen leaving a trail of potato peelings down your path because you only gave them 10 bob. And Ebenezer said, "I didn't know this. I didn't know any of this." The figure said, "Wait, now let me show you Christmas future, next Christmas." And Ebenezer saw this vision. Newspapers doing their special Christmas shopping supplement at the beginning of August. Stuff called instant Christmas pudding. Battery turkeys. And the whole nation being stopped on the way home for breathalyzer tests. Ebenezer Scrooge said, "Enough, enough, show me..." And he woke up. At that moment he woke up, and there was the daylight streaming into his room. He rushed to the window, and outside there was this urchin boy. He shouted out to him, "Hey boy, what day is it?" And the boy shouted back, "Of all glorious days in the year, it is Christmas Day." And with one smooth overarm action, Ebenezer lifted the coal bucket, threw it and felled the urchin to the ground. Jumped on his moped, rode out to Salisbury Plain, and stayed there till the middle of January, when the last Christmas decoration came down and you could get a shop assistant to stop and talk to you. He moved to Tangiers. He's a changed man and as nice a bloke as you would wish to meet. Which all goes to show that even in the best of Charles Dickens, there is always a touch of overstating the case. Or as that old proverb says, there is no Charlie D, but hath a smack of folly.
Well, that's absolutely terrible. I'm not going to have this Christmas at all after that. And with that absolutely terrible story, Dennis wins the contest of the two stories, but it brings us to a final marking after the toing and praying, in which there's an exact equality of marks between the two teams, and that's a pretty rare occurrence. It also brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Dilys Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir and Dennis Norden, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC. ¶¶